Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to SFF Addicts, a bi-weekly panel podcast featuring writers from fanficaddict.com, authors, publishing professionals, bloggers, and more, where we come together to chat about science fiction and fantasy, as well as the occasional jaunt into the wider SFF industry. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and today's episode is my interview with author and actor Luke Arnold. As an actor, Luke is known for his role as Long John Silver on the Starz TV show Black Sails, and as an author, he's written three books in the Fetch Phillips archives, the newest of which, One Foot in the Fade, is out today, April 26th, via Orbit Books. Luke and I had an awesome conversation, digging into that book and the Fetch series as a whole, balancing acting and writing, morally great characters and worlds, and much, much more. All right, now on to my interview with Luke Arnold. Here we go. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another author chat on SFF Addicts. And today I have the pleasure of chatting with Luke Arnold. He is an actor and fantasy author. As the former, he performed the role of Long John Silver in the Starz series Black Sails and is featured in numerous other television shows and films. And as an author, he has penned three books in the Fetch Phillips archives, including The Last Smile in Sunder City, which I have right here. Love these covers. They are fantastic. As well as book number two, Dead Man in a Ditch, and book three, One Foot in the Fade, which is out today, April 26th. So congratulations on the new release, Luke, and welcome to the show. How you doing?
Yeah, really well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Yeah. I mean, first off, how are you feeling about the launch of book three?
Yeah, I'm really excited. It was kind of funny because the first two came out both in 2020, which was not really the ideal year to be a debut author, but and especially with two books at once. But it was kind of fun to have them out right on the back of each other, and it did kind of give it a nice little momentum and felt like it, you know, they kind of landed there together in a really fun way. And then it's been a little bit of a break, so it's nice to have a new Fetch story coming out into the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. Although 2020, I think a lot of people got back into reading in a big way, so it might have been a good boon for you to get in there.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think a lot of people did get back into reading, but I feel mostly what everyone did was, like, you know, in first week of lockdown, just ordered Infinite Jest and Moby Dick and all these books that they intended to read, where, you know, as a new author,
you kind of not fantasy detective fiction, forget about that.
Well, not new stuff, I guess. You know, it's that kind of thing. I think a lot of, and look, it all still feels very new to me. But that thing of, like, being a new author often relies a lot on, you know, going into bookstores and you know, meeting people face to face, doing events, you know. And so it was interesting. It's funny as a debut author coming in and you're waiting for people to tell you, like, hey, this is how things work. This is what we usually do. You know, and instead everyone's going, like, we have no idea what we're doing anymore. It's everything's been thrown out. That's it. Shit's in the fan. So I don't know if you've got any ideas. And so I think everyone was kind of scrambling to go, like, all right, all the festivals are moving online. Trying to, you know, social media has to play a bigger part of it. And so, yeah, it will, I think definitely people were reading a little bit more, but it did create some other issues. But, you know, the fun thing about books is it's not like, you know, a movie's opening weekend or something. You get to kind of put them out in the world and people will find them. And if they like them, they'll tell other people. So it has a longer evolution, I think.
Yeah. It's like a more of a slow burn, but it feels more natural in a way. Yeah. Whereas movies and I guess TV shows are on a similar wavelength to books, but like a film would be like, we're going to force this down your throat because we have to make money at the box office as soon as we can.
Yeah, that's it. It's all about that opening weekend with films. Yeah. And saying that, you know, you rely so much, it's amazing with TV shows that so much of the, like, reviews are based on the first couple of episodes, which, you know, and so I'm sure when you're making something, you're always going, like, okay, yeah, we want to have a nice natural lead in. We want to build the story, but you're like, but if that pilot isn't great, then our Rotten Tomatoes score is ruined forever. And and then who cares what we do? So, yeah, there's something natural, more natural and maybe a bit fair about the way it works with books.
Yeah. And we'll jump into a bit of your acting as well as the Fetch Phillips archives. But first, this is a question I like to ask my guests right off the bat to sort of ease into things and get to know you a bit more. But what was your relationship like with SFF and reading growing up?
I read a lot growing up, and I think I was always drawn and always and have been drawn to things. Maybe it wasn't always a lot of full SFF stuff, but always things with a bit of magic realism or some element of that in there. Like, I was a big reader when I was little, and, you know, but it would have been all the typical, you know, went through a big Goosebumps phase or, you know, whatever at primary school and that kind of stuff. And and then lots of comic books as well. I think my first ambitions, like when I was young, was to write and draw comics was my first kind of, you know, and first kind of things I was writing and creating. So that's kind of where it all began. And it's funny, I kind of dedicate the first book to my dad for introducing me to the Raymond Chandler detective stories and to Tolkien, because he did. I vividly remember him kind of reading me Lord of the Rings, like, you know, as a bedtime story for a period of time. And we never got through it. It kind of like we got to it a bit. At a certain point, it kind of, you know, other things took over. It's really long. But even the beginning of that idea. And I think that would have been, you know, it's that great period as you start to, when you're a kid and you're watching your own stuff, and then when you get to start experiencing things that your parents like. And I think my dad was a real influence of going, hey, like, let's go watch, you know, the black and white Zorro movies or, you know, and find some of those other things. So it kind of just in there, it definitely was dropped in as one of those early influences of, as I was getting out of, I guess, kids' books into finding out what else films, books, and things were out there. But then I do think I really, I'd say as things went on, I probably read a bit less and less sci-fi fantasy as I was growing up. And, you know, like I'd go back and dabble. I read some Discworld stuff early on. I think I probably played the video games of that first, like the Discworld point and click adventures. And
I didn't even know there were any Discworld point and click adventures.
Yeah, so there's two. That sounds awesome. I think the first two, they're on PC, but also I think I played the first one on PlayStation 1. And Eric Idle does the voice of Rincewind, I'm pretty sure. And so there's a kind of Python-esque energy to the whole thing, which obviously matches.
That's very, very well. Fitting for, yeah. For Terry Pratchett, though.
Yeah, it's really quite cool. So that, I think I got a lot of that in, like, that introduction there. And that, so that's, and I probably dropped over to Discworld from that stuff. And I do think video games is probably where I was digesting a lot of sci-fi fantasy. Like, you know, there are themes in a lot of stuff, but when I went back and played the remake of Final Fantasy VII, when that came out a couple of years ago, I was like, well, I really took a lot. Like, I think there's more of that stuff in Sunder City than I think I first realized. Obviously, yeah. There's lots of those themes, but there was it was like that, I think, was a big fantasy influence that came in probably when I was starting to, you know, when I was in high school and starting to write more stuff. So yeah, and then it really, I've had to, so it means I've had to play catch up a lot. I think suddenly, you know, in my mind, when I first started writing the short story that this would all be based on, yeah, I was more thinking about, like, I was going back and reading the Raymond Chandler detective stories and some of those other classic, like the Dashiell Hammett stuff, more than I was going back to fantasy, I think. And then it was when Orbit picked it up and was like, hey, you're a fantasy author now, you know, and I'm like, oh, and you're, you know, you've got this new cohort. I was like, well, okay, I've really got to go back and read some stuff. So I have, over the last couple of years, been playing a lot of catch up from how familiar I was with the genre and where it had kind of gone in recent years than I was before.
That's kind of nice, though. It's like you get this resurgence just based on the fact that you are creatively putting out like fantasy stuff, and it's kind of like, shit, that kind of forced my hand. I got to catch up and see what's out there.
That's right. And it's a really interesting time to do it as well, I think. Yeah. Like because I wasn't like a big fantasy head growing up, it's not like I got, you know, there's this whole, I guess, real shift that's been happening, and it's always been there. But it becoming more into focus, where it's not just a very, I guess, white European male view of fantasy that, you know, that kind of held so much of the genre before, and now things are breaking out. Like for me, I've done most of my reading recently. And so I kind of, and it's like, wow, there's so many different ways of exploring these fantasy and sci-fi elements. And so then it's like, oh, cool, I'll go back and pick up some of those classics. But it does seem a really great time now to get into sci-fi fantasy, because there's a lot more diverse, interesting, different voices coming to the forefront as than there maybe were in decades before.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's a good time. This is like the golden age from my perspective of sci-fi and fantasy, you know?
Yeah.
So people say like, oh, the golden age is back in like the 70s. No.
Yeah.
Right now.
There's so many places to go now, like so many things to pick up where you're like, yeah. And I think that, because I think that was actually, and look, there'll always be derivative stuff. And there was always other things out there if you had a means to go find it that maybe weren't rising to the top as far as, you know, the word of mouth or getting put on bookstores before the internet existed. I do think I dabbled a few times in maybe after reading certain comics or watching shows. I never played Dungeons & Dragons growing up, but I remember seeing like the Saturday morning cartoon and going like, oh, I find this kind of interesting. And that led me to pick up some fantasy books, I think, around that time. Ones I wouldn't even remember, but those, you know, those ones that just felt like that's so much derivative from that world where there's almost a level of assumed knowledge and like, I was like, hey, you're just going to open the first page. We're going to hit you with 50 different made up words of different names and places. And I was just like, oh, this doesn't really do it for me at all.
Yeah.
And I think a couple of those experiences early on meant that I maybe didn't read some of those classics when I could have, because I was just like, they felt a little bit impenetrable.
Jargon overload, man.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool. And you know, obviously you mentioned that you were writing a bit in high school and then you wrote the short story that eventually became Fetch Phillips. But, you know, between all of this, you became a professional actor and you've been acting for many years. At which point did you're reading so many scripts? I imagine that took up a lot of your reading time for sure. But when did you decide you wanted to, you know, really diversify your creativity and put more effort into, you know, writing fantasy, writing Fetch Phillips short story and all that?
Yeah, so I guess until my acting career took off, well, like at school it was all kind of the same. I was just involved in anything creative. And then when I was working out where to go do university or like, you know, I was deciding like, okay, am I going to go to acting school? Am I going to go to film school? Am I going to do a writing course? And I'd done a job in the film industry already, which meant that it put some money in my bank account, and I kind of had this, my gap year when I mostly worked, but then was able to sit and prepare for all those things. So I got into a course of each kind, and something just felt like, I think acting might be the, like, I think I might become a, I kind of had a sense that I'd become a better maybe writer and filmmaker through life experience and doing other things. Mm-hmm. And we're getting in, like being an actor in my 20s felt like, the good thing is it's also quite communal as well. Like there's something about going like, okay, the other one's going to require a lot of time sitting in a room on my own and being self-disciplined, which actually does require more of that than people think as well. Like most of the work is done on your own in a room going over the script, and kind of what you do with everyone else is gravy. But it is a more, especially going to drama school, a much more collaborative, explorative, vibrant place than maybe the other courses would have been. And it just felt right at that time. And then you're right. And so still through that time and make some of my own stuff, would still do a bit of writing. But it's different when you always know that if the call comes to go do an acting job, I'm going to take it. And so it's hard to completely get invested in the other thing when you're like, yeah, but you know, if I got a call to be on some average show, but it's going to be a paycheck and help the resume, I'm going to take that. It's always going to be compromised. And then you're right as well that I still have a little bit of a regret about how many hours of my life I've spent reading bad scripts, because that's what you have to do as an actor. And it doesn't really go away. And just that thing of reading scripts, putting down auditions, like reading scripts, learning lines, doing auditions, it just eats so much time and it's so much of what you read. And then things were ticking over and doing most of that, and then got Black Sails, the pirate show where I played Long John Silver. And I think a few elements came together on that. One being the kind of cast we had. And it was like the cast you'd get when you're doing a play, which is generally very like well-read, creative, interesting people who we're all in South Africa. We're generally all put up in these kind of apartments together, and we've got a lot of work to do, but we've also got a bunch of time sitting around. And when you've got people like Toby Stevens, who played Flint, and Toby Schmitz, who played Rackham, who are voracious readers, very well read, very creative in their own right. And so, and both of them, I think, had a different level of education than me, and kind of, you know, I didn't really grow up in a family or a, you know, went to a kind of school that's that extremely well-read, kind of thing. It was like my dad's very smart and has read a lot, but there's a certain kind of culture, I think, that some people get, especially then people out of, you know, I think in England have generally a different kind of vibe and culture around art and reading and literature than a lot of people in Australia might.
It's a bit more posh.
Yeah, and just it's a thing people do and talk about, you know, and it's part of their history. And it's and so I was just like, I think, very excited about being around this group, and kind of suddenly was like, oh, I get to be around these very, intelligent, generous people who are always going, oh, you should read this, read that. And so I think that kicked that up. And then at the same time, as we got to the end of it, just for me as an actor, it was that job and some other jobs that I'd been able to do during those 4 years I was on Black Sails were just far and above what I expected I might ever get to do as an actor. I was really proud of the work on that. I felt it was something, like everyone on Black Sails felt like those roles were ours and we were part of the creative process, and we got to really give everything to those characters over that time. And so as it was wrapping up, that feeling of, like, I just felt very satisfied as an actor, I guess. That actor in me that, you know, going like, oh, I hope I get to do this one day. And that was like, I think that was it. And that may or may not be the best thing I ever get to do, you know, and as far as the most satisfying creatively. So it really meant that writer in me who'd been sitting dormant, it was almost going like, okay, we've done that. Could we put some time into the other stuff? And I really felt like, oh, yeah, I can now. I can go and spend all day. I mean, all day, like weeks and months, focusing on writing, not auditioning. You know, maybe something really great comes through, but happy to just go like, I'm busy with other stuff for the moment. I want to focus on this. I want to give it all my attention. Yeah. And so that's kind of, I think, being able to have that acting job that made me satisfied, let me give my full focus to that, which was a real joy and something I feel very grateful for.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing, because it sounds like, you know, I've had experiences like this where it's like this, you know, a lot of people talk about the zone in regards to sports or other things, but it's like, for me, creativity and like doing something like writing, or in my case, like I was a tattoo artist, I draw a lot and stuff like that. There's like this creative symbiosis that comes through just like the process, you know, and especially if you're doing something collaborative, like acting and being on a set with these other intelligent people, their creativity is just feeding back into you. And at the end of it, it's just like, you know, maybe from like my personal perspective, a bit of like a waste to just not put that creativity into something really tangible.
Yeah. Well, that's right. That we spent 4 years just like, all working together, building this stuff. And, you know, that's kind of where, I mean, I have a creative mind. That's what lights it up. That's what it wants to be doing. And so when you're with a cast that, even though we're going to go out and we're, you know, we definitely drank our way through the, you know, enough castle lights, the local beer.
You were pirates, man.
Hit them afloat. Exactly. But still, we'd always come back to, as we're sitting around, you'd be going like, okay, so how are we going to play that thing on the next day? Or someone going like, hey, I'm thinking of changing this line, what do you think? Like, all our minds were still on this thing, because we knew it could be great, and that it was great, and that we were the actors actually got to be some part of the engine of this in cohesion with everyone else. Our ideas were respected. What we were bringing to it was respected. We as a group were willing to go above and beyond with the rehearsals and the work to make sure that we could give everything to the production. And so you've got all that energy. And then as you're getting to the end of it, and now there's, you know, we start shooting scenes, and for the first time, there's no new scenes coming in, that our creative engines were so kind of well honed and ready to go that it was quite easy to just go like, all right, let's just put all that stuff into writing a book now. Because and then as well, it's great when you've got those great minds around. I wrote the short story version over a weekend, and then Toby Stevens was one of the first people to read it, and Schmitz read it, and Jessica Parker Kenny, I think, was the first one to read it and tell me like, hey, this is really good, I like this. It's like, yeah, I think this could be a book. And you know, having people that you respect and admire tell you that they like what you're doing is, I mean, writing, you have to rely on, and all of us do it, everything, but with writing, you have to go through long stretches of relying on that kind of self-belief as it bashes up against your fear and your imposter syndrome and all those things there, that having some people like that say that they liked reading what you wrote can definitely help you get through those first hurdles.
Yeah, because especially at the beginning, there's just that motivational deficit of fucking self-doubt and all this crap that just tells you like, yeah, why is anyone, like you mentioned, imposters, and why does anyone want to read your work? It's like, I don't know. Why would they want to read my work? So, I mean, it's amazing. Like, it's really so cool to hear that you had this, these people around you, this environment that really fostered your confidence and your creativity in that way. And, you know, the short story, I want to hear more about where the initial idea for Fetch Phillips came from. You mentioned Raymond Chandler as well. So what were sort of the origins of the short story? And then how did that, once it got picked up by Orbit, how did that sort of transition and blossom into the full world and character that we know today?
Yeah. So look, I think I'd written a version of, like, the very beginning of this when I was 17, actually. Yeah, maybe 17, actually. Like, a version of a kind of gumshoe in a fantasy world.
Yeah.
At that time, it still had its magic. It was a bit of that, like, a pretty just clear, you know, using all the tropes, having fun with it. Look, I think I did a similar, I remember doing a sci-fi thing in that world in, like, it must have been in year 7 or something as well. Like, I think I always liked the kind of gumshoe idea. I love film noir. And so it was both the cinematic thing. I'd watch all the bogey movies and love going down that road, as well as read, like, yeah, Dad read the Raymond Chandler books. And so I read them, and I really liked his humor and the style. And I think he was one of those characters that I just connected with early on. There was something in Philip Marlowe that I just went, this feels like my kind of guy. And that we all have those kind of comfort books we go back to, and Chandler was that for me.
He's kind of like the relatable everyman, you know?
Yeah. And there's something, like, I love Raymond Chandler has a fantastic essay, The Simple Art of Murder, is it? Or is that the short story? Oh, anyway, there's an essay where he talks about who the noir hero is. And I remember reading that, and it's just like, I love, there's something about that as the hero. There's something about the kind of his quiet code, you know, it's a great description. It's really good to go read.
I need to read that. I love Raymond's work. I haven't read that.
Yeah. I'll find it I'll find it. So I'll send it to you, and if you put it in the show notes or whatever, it's a great little just description of who the noir hero should be. And I guess that may be imprinted on me a little bit because I loved Marlowe. Yeah. There's something about the sense of humor, the way his kind of simmering self-loathing rides against exactly that, a code and a modest righteousness and a sense of right and wrong in a broken place. You know, just, you know, they're things that went like, okay, I like this kind of hero. And it's the kind of hero that, you know, it's matches a kind of Indiana Jones and those other kind of guys that I guess I'd already seen on film and telly. And I felt writing that voice came naturally, quite naturally to me, I guess, compared to writing certain other kinds of stories. So when I decided to write a story, often that kind of hero would be at the center of it. Then when I was at drama school, in one of the holiday breaks when I didn't have enough money to travel out of Perth where I was staying, but pretty much everyone else did. I wrote, I guess, you know, what it would have been like 30,000 words or something of a version before school came back, and thought like, oh, I'll continue that, and then never got back to actually doing that version. But it did let me practice with some of the world stuff and build some other characters that have actually been in, you know, had come to play a part of it, but then left it again for, you know, beyond 10 years or whatever before I then wrote that short story during the Black Sails time, because the other cast said they kind of liked it. Then when we finished, I went, well, that's what I'm doing now. I'm turning this into a book. And then I guess over the course of that year, I'd write it, you know, I turned it into a full book form, was lucky enough again to have some people read it. A friend of mine, Stephen Loughran, who wrote, he's done a couple of kind of more like middle grade series, one called Paladero about a dinosaur riding cowboys, which is really great. Nice. And he works in publishing too. So he was my first, you know, another person I really had to rely on to go like, is this something? Does this work? Am I doing the right thing? What do I do with it now? And so it was, Lockers was great for that, as well as Daphne or Olive, who, if there are any Black Sails fans, there's a podcast called Fathoms Deep that she was one of the hosts of, and she was one of the early readers as well. And so they helped being those positive voices I needed while I was turning the short story into a novel size. The rewrites I did there, started handing it out to lit agents and publishers and was getting some bites, and then Orbit came along.
Man, that's awesome. And like Philip Marlowe, the simmering protagonist, this story simmered for years and years and years before coming to light. But I love that, you know, it's like, it's something that spoke true to you, and you felt like however long this idea has been in your head, you stuck with it and you understood like, this is something that I'm really passionate about. And now here you are, it's like three books into the series. It's fantastic.
Yeah, no, it is bizarre. And I think what really unlocked it, which was interesting, is I think at some point, what maybe helped me, because maybe when you go back and write it and there can be things you go, oh, this is fun, or I like this style. And that's probably what I was doing the first few times. And then, and even maybe the short story was still kind of mostly that maybe, but then the thing I think I maybe unlocked for myself when I was turning it into the full manuscript was maybe dissecting why I liked this noir hero, why I attached to it, what I thought those heroes, what they represented to me, and why it was maybe a flawed idea to want to aspire to be someone like that. Like, it's so cool to be, the idea, and I'd kind of go back and realize that like, oh, it was a somewhat insecure teenager. The idea of like when you look at Bogart playing these characters and he's just so, he doesn't care anymore because something awful's happened to him, so he doesn't give a shit, he doesn't care what anyone thinks. Yeah. And it just felt like going, oh God, I can't wait till I turn into that. That looks like so much easier than all this weird social anxiety I get every time I open my mouth. Yeah. And then of course, as you grow up, you go like, well, that's not. It does, one, it doesn't feel good to be.
It's like the asshole person as aspiration doesn't really work out in the real world.
That's right. Well, and even if you go like, oh yeah, like, hey, maybe it does make things easier when you just cop out of everything like that, but it doesn't make you a good person in any way. It doesn't make you good to the people around you. It doesn't make you a useful part of society. And so I think then when that kind of opened up to going, like, I started finding that interesting because, like, when I write stuff, I'd like, I don't think I know how to write. I'd never be able to write something where I feel like I've got a real message I want to tell people. And this book's going to drive that message home because I'm so full of self-doubt, or always, I constantly will question what I think, that there's no way I'll get to the end of the book without going like, you piece of shit, who do you think you are that you've got some bit of wisdom you're going to bestow on people and preaching teach them some lesson? Yeah, like, it has to be because there's something I don't know, and that maybe through writing this I can explore and get underneath that feeling or that idea in my head or that question I have. And
like writing in story is like self-discovery in a way.
Yeah. And then you go and you have to have enough kind of belief in, you know, your own experience and your mind to go like, oh, good, if I'm thinking about this stuff, I imagine someone out there must be, and that me putting the time into this might uncover some stuff or have some thoughts that will either be interesting to them or reveal new stuff to them as it reveals it to me, or just lets them know that thing that we want from a lot of art is just to go like, oh, my weird mind that I feel like I'm like some individual freak is actually really quite common and a lot of people think the same. So yeah, that it's that's the kind of thing. And I think there was something in the in Fetch, the whole thing being a bit of the kind of disillusioned idea of when the world seems magical when you're little, and then you grow up and you look around and it's suddenly not so magical anymore. But you have a kind of sneaking suspicion that that's your fault, that it's because of the things you went after and the choices you made and the things you did to yourself to make yourself seem like a man or a grown up or, you know, a serious person in the world or, you know, whoever. And there was something in that that I found interesting, and that's probably what, in conjunction with everything else, propelled me to be able to get through a full manuscript and to go back and rewrite it the million times you need to rewrite it, because I was trying to get to the heart of something that was gnawing away at my own brain.
Yeah, just the jaded nature of growing up and everything like that.
Yeah.
But that leads perfectly into, you know, because for me, Fetch is the heart of the series. And it sounds like he is for you. You know, he's the soul of the story and what's propelling everything forward, and this sort of magic, non-magic dichotomy is actually something that really defines the world, and it defines his arc as a character. And you were part of a TBRCon panel about morally gray characters back in January, and you touched upon a few things that you brought up there. But I really love that, you know, Fetch himself, I wouldn't necessarily say that he's like an outright morally gray character, but this is something that Fonda Lee mentioned to me back in the fall. I don't create morally gray characters, I create morally gray worlds, and the characters that inhabit them just so happen to fall into certain trappings of whatever that world has established. So for you, you know, you have this nice balance between Fetch as, you know, a bit of a dick sometimes, but he's like on a soul searching mission, but at the same time, he's also an everyman and he's very relatable. So how did you go about balancing those aspects of his personality, but also giving him that surrounding world that is also morally questionable, and then giving the story itself, you know, the emotions and friendships and everything that sort of makes it feel more genuine and human?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it's you make the right character for the world and the right world for the character. And that Fetch really wouldn't be, you couldn't pluck him out and put him in a different story, in a different world, because it all the richness of his experience comes through the, you know, that the fact he is in a world that has recently lost its magic, that he is partly responsible for and feels personally very responsible for. And so that's going to taint his experience with everyone else. It's a reason, and because that hits that kind of dark, there's such a dark romantic quality to that, that everywhere he looks, so it's a reason to also get away with those kind of noirish descriptions, because you know, it's always got like, well, why does this character care about this stuff? You know, and like for him, it's like, oh, he'll go into detail about describing the way things were because he remembers how affecting it was for him when he first walked into Sunder City. He didn't know magic existed. He escapes from his walled off city, and he remembers his defining time as a young man, how incredible it was to see all this in its heyday. And now all the shine's taken off everything, and he sees his own guilt reflected back. So the world and Fetch is so intertwined that, you know, in my mind, then every bit of description becomes revealing about his character, and vice versa, everything he does, and the, you know, the plot, the character, the world building is all together. And so at that point, you know, kind of whatever seems interesting to write about feels like it's going to serve multiple things. And so, and then it is interesting as you go, because it's funny, you can want to do certain things, and at a certain point, Fetch does have his own stuff and his things that he struggles with, and he needs to, he's not going to be the man that he wishes he could be. He's not going to react in the ways that he wishes he could. his emotions are going to get the better of him. His, you know, traumas are going to influence the way he reacts to stuff. He's going to, I mean, we all know what it's like to be in situations and have a voice in your head telling you to act a certain way or do something, and you just can't, because, you know, we can't always be who we hope we are, which is a huge thing for Fetch. And
exactly.
It's interesting you say about the other, you know, the secondary characters as well. It's been one of the tough things with Fetch that I think, you know, one of the things, if you don't like yourself, it can be very hard to build good strong connections and true connections with other people, because, you know, you're just always going, well, why would they, like, you know, it's hard to think of anyone being your real friend, because you're like, well, why would they like me? Because I'm obviously the piece of shit who broke the world and can't seem to get anything right. And so,
but then it's just this like positive, in parentheses, air quotes, negative feedback loop, where it's just like, I think I'm a piece of shit, so why would anybody like me? And then everyone else is just like, he thinks he's a piece of shit, I don't like that. And then nobody wants to hang out with you.
Exactly. And I think, and so that's the thing, where you, with Fetch, you go like you have all these secondary characters, and you see some of them who kind of really care for him or have these, you know, and obviously see him as his own worst enemy, as I imagine a lot of readers do, and he is. And so that is interesting, building a, you know, building this cast of characters, and but having, knowing our protagonist is kind of hamstrung by those, his connection to his guilt and his own self-loathing, which is another form of self-obsession, the same as, you know, narcissism or anything like that. And so, yeah, you've kind of got this fantasy, this dying fantasy world, and this kind of dangling quest there of like, but could we go turn the magic back? But what's really going on is, it's all inside Fetch and his personal journey of going like, okay, what have you got to sort out in yourself so you can actually be a good force for the people struggling with what they're struggling with here. And so, yeah, and it's just been really interesting, because I find that stuff really interesting. And then you work out, okay, what magical creatures or characters do we get to build around him to reflect that stuff back? But which is also then the noir stuff, like, you know, that whole idea of the morally gray or dark world, that's what all noir is, you know, like the classic line at the end of Chinatown, you know, where, like, you forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. It's like all the worst things happen. And it's like, yeah, what do you expect?
It is what it is,
like,
man.
Yeah. Oh, you tried to be a better man, did you? Like, well, guess what? That's not the way the world works. And so there's also that stuff going on where, you know, trying to work out, Fetch is trying to work out what you actually do when, you know, and sometimes it's like, okay, is it about me doing this thing? Should I help this person? Do I need to be a violent man in a violent world? And it's for me, it's interesting because it's something I think about. And I guess as we all watch the world fall apart around us, we, you know, a lot of us have those kind of questions too. So it's a bit of a feeling of getting to explore some of that stuff in maybe the safe world of Sunder City rather than, going and making my own life too messy in the real world at the moment.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that Sunder City is safe, but go to the Sickle, you'll get fucked up. But yeah,
oh, safe for me. Yeah. I mean,
as
I can
creator,
make stuff
it is my
happen. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I really love what you did in terms of this balance between, you know, the world building and the character. Like you said, they're all intertwined, but you strike a nice balance between all of that. And I love how you've fleshed out this world with each consecutive book. And Sunder City really feels like a foil for Fetch's internal turmoil and all the crap that he's dealing with and sort of like projecting out onto the world itself. Because you see other characters and other creatures who are like, I'm an actual magical creature who got fucked over by the magic just being shut off. So how do you think I feel, you know, whereas Fetch is a human. And so humans were unaffected by this physically. And so I like how you establish that. And it's just like, Fetch is in his own head a lot. And you said a lot of readers think he's his own worst enemy. And that is true in noir, but that is true in this case too. But, you know, Sunder City, I think for me, acts as like this nice foundational character throughout the series on Fetch's side. So it's like, as the story is progressing, Sunder City is changing as much as Fetch is changing. And you really created this place, this setting that feels alive, you know? So how did you go about creating that city in the first place? And then at the same time, giving it sort of like a distinct history and character as well.
Yeah, I did. I think a lot of it just happened. I think I started writing first in a way that's maybe not the least cool way. Oh no, in this crowd, it's great. Like it's almost like I think when I wrote that first short story, I hadn't thought too much about it. And I just kind of took Fetch out on the streets, and it's almost like playing D&D on the fly, going like, okay, so it goes here. So what's that going to be like? And letting it, knowing the themes I was playing with and where Fetch was, what's the most interesting thing for him to come across at that moment? And also, you know, your mind just starts to fill in the gaps with certain things, which is really nice. And then, you know, through edits, you work out what actually serves, what maybe doesn't, you know, or sometimes you go like, oh, that has an interesting feeling to it, but at the moment it's not really doing much for the story, so work out what can happen there to tie things in. So I didn't do lots of, and then maybe it was probably only when like the manuscript was done or I'd done a couple of drafts, it was like, okay, I'd better open up another document here and start jotting down some actual historical notes and some characters so I can keep track of this stuff. Because, you know, it kind of grew somewhat organically. And then with, I'd say, books 2 and 3, which I actually planned, that's more where then I'd write some big documents going in and go like, okay, I better build some history here first and work out. But it's always in flux. And that's like, it's why I don't do too much world building outside what's particularly needed for the story right now. Because I don't see much sense in having anything like start to set things in stone in my head if they're not going to be in the story. It can sometimes be, you know, nice. And I know some writers, it really helps with the authenticity of their world and that, you know, they know more than what's said here. But for me, I kind of like to be able to feel like it's all still, you know, none of the paint is set. And at any point you can shift things as needed if you're like, oh, that's actually going to help tie this in. And, you know, because if there's, you know, I think the books, it's tough because the books always have an inherent dissatisfaction in them because they're noir and it's kind of the nature of them. But, you know, especially with books, you know, like with book 2, it was like, okay, this is going to be a bit more of a tighter case than the first one was, with kind of all these interweaving elements, and you go, maybe that's what people are turning up for that. And then it's a character study, and you know, so you want to make sure Fetch's journey all feels right and connected, and you want the world building to be there. And it's interesting that I do wonder, like, if someone else had published it, whether it would be like, I do think in the edits I've had to take more of a focus on world building because I'm like, oh, like once it's coming out with Orbit, like a SFS publisher, it's like, oh, this is really now a fantasy book. And I know it always was, but it's funny in my head, it had happening more of a, you know, detective story set in a fantasy world. It's something that happens a bit organically. I have kind of planned out some big stuff overall. A lot of that's more character stuff. And I do have some histories, like I know some histories and some historical characters, and I've written out when certain things changed and when certain creatures were born and when cities and stuff were made. So I've got a bunch of that there. I think naturally for me, it's maybe my least interesting part of the whole stuff until it actually ties in with what the character's doing at a particular moment.
Yeah, but I mean, it feels natural in the sense that Fetch's own personal history ties into the major pivotal event in this world.
Yeah.
Which is the shift from, you know, a magical world to a non-magical sort of like dying world in a way, in the sense of like the magical creatures. And that only takes place, I think, 6 years or so before the first book.
Yeah.
More or less. And then in books 2 and 3, you know, I think exactly what you mentioned, like what serves the purpose of the story, and you naturally built upon the world as the characters left Sunder City. So there are some moments where it's like you get to spend a bit of time in Dead Men in a Ditch outside of the city, and then a good portion of One Foot in the Fade is spent on this sort of really, really cool just I won't spoil anything.
Fetch is trying to
there's a a journey that he takes with a group of characters, and it's sort of like, get the gang together and then we're gonna go steal some shit, and it's really good. Yeah. I won't say anything beyond that because it's a really awesome section of the book, but you know,
good, I'm glad you had, well, it is like I will say with book three, it's where Fetch is trying to be a fantasy hero. Is yeah. And you get a section exactly. that's living up to that a bit. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's like, he's literally just trying to embody this ideal of, you know, my own personal hero's journey. But then you bring back that noir sort of like critique of just like, are you really a hero though? Like, what are yeah. you fighting for? All that kind of stuff. So I really love that. But at the same time, it's like, you get to see more of Archetelos, and you get to expand on this world a little bit and see, like, outside of Sunder City, which is sort of like the mecca of modernization and industrialization, what the fuck's going on out there? People are like in the shit, you know?
Yeah. And that's, which is something that definitely in further ones get to explore more. It's nice kind of getting a taste of it now, I guess, and seeing where it goes. And then, yeah, seeing some glimpses there, because it's another thing as well. And I think what I maybe relied on it's funny, relying on the fact, yeah, of Fetch's naivety is really useful, that he grew up sheltered. He's then mostly, he got to tour around a bit as a soldier, but, you know, I think as a soldier, it's like, okay, we're going to go here, we're going to do this thing, follow these orders. Mm-hmm. He has not spent much time actually out in other cultures, in other cities, living. So Sunder City is what he knows. And he didn't even know about that until he was, you know, he'd gone through all his schooling years and was a young man. So that ignorance really helps. And him also not always being the smartest guy as well. Like, I'm working on another project recently, which haven't been able to announce, but have a much smarter character. And it's like, oh, this is a lot tougher to write. When you're like, oh, this guy has to know some shit. It's like, oh, give me a dum-dum to write. It's much easier.
Just like the blockhead can just kind of fumble his way into situations and, you know, fumble his way out of them as well. But if it's a smart character, and ask questions, I have to be smart. Shit.
Exactly. It's a lot more work to write smart characters. There's something very comfortable about writing Fetch's naive, dumbed up, you know, and at certain points, you know, like, I don't think there's been many great inconsistencies in it, but if there is, you can go like, oh yeah, well, Fetch's take a lot of hits to the head. You know, he sometimes gets his facts mixed up. Yeah. So, but yeah, it is, there's something fun about that and about Fetch. Yeah, look, it's you know, I'm not by no means the first one to do it. You know, writing as the audience surrogate, have someone who knows less and then gets to discover the world with them. And Fetch is constantly on the back foot, which definitely helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then sort of, you know, we talked about this noir element of having like, I guess like the code, what have you, sort of like a moral compass within a morally gray world. But I think Fetch acts as a really good window through which to see, I want to see this world rejuvenated with the magic that I, rejuvenated with the magic that I had a part in plucking away from all of these creatures. But at the same time, sort of coming to grips with the fact that this world might not necessarily want that back, or the fact that there's a tastier carrot on the end of the stick with modernization and industrialization, factories and cars and all this glitzy shit that people are just like, oh, the lights are back on, so we're cool with this, and we don't necessarily feel the need to put any mental capacity into thinking about what it was like before, because this is here now and life is tough and I'm just going to roll with it, you know? So I like how you had that nature and magic versus industrialization kind of take a front seat in the series, which is really powerful, especially when Sunder City is this sort of like iconic city in this world and people are just getting swept up in it, you know?
Yeah, and it's tough because it's fun, you know, writing it and going like, sometimes you're like it's all complicated. That same thing, that once again, like that morally gray world that you were saying Fonda mentioned, because you go, yeah, like, and that's kind of one of the tough questions of the second book, where it's just like, well, Yeah, like everyone's running towards this thing. And one of the problems is that if you do that, you're putting a lot of power in the hands of some immoral people and some people who might be doing this and, you know, who are compromising other people, and it might be leading us to a bad place. But you're like, yeah, but it's got the heating on. So, you know, like yeah. You might have a bunch of real like ideals and you might see where this is going and that this is bad, but, you know, do you want people to freeze to death in their homes so you can create a better world? And that it's complicated stuff, and it's things that I, you know, questions that everyone kind of deals with, and that, you know, right now we all as a humanity have a lot of questions to ask about the compromises we want to make to our quality of life for the future, you know, and it's like, and that what we ask, what we want, the things that we think, you know, maybe some of us say we should do as a collective, but are we willing to do them as individuals, or,
yeah,
you know, or vice versa, and that stuff. So, yeah, it's, there's something in it as a, you know, sometimes you throw something in there and you think it's, when you start to do it, it feels fairly black and white and you feel like, cool, I've got something to say about this. And then as you dig in, you're like, you know, if you write honestly and you really put yourself in there and make sure you've got a bunch of other characters coming in with different points of view, you can start to create something where every way you turn it, you can see it, you know, see a different angle. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it's, and that's kind of maybe part of the fun of the third one of, you know, for a little bit, maybe trying to, you know, feeling Fetch's desire to go back to a simpler time and see things in a simpler way, and that maybe you want to pick up as a reader and go like, you know, like, can't we just have a satisfying fantasy quest for a little bit? And it's like, well, we'll flirt with it, but we'll see where it goes. Yeah.
Flirt is a good word for that, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And now that you're, you know, three books into the series, we've touched on it a little bit, but sort of how has your approach been for writing each consecutive sequel and, you know, your writing process, but also, you know, we've talked about confidence as a writer and that kind of stuff. How has your confidence evolved? How has your sort of like sense of the craft evolved?
Yeah. Oh, it's weird. So, I mean, it's the first one, I didn't know I was writing a book. You know, it started as a short story and some people read mm-hmm. it. And then I think at one point I thought like, oh, I'll just do, like, I'll make it a more, like, there'll be a bunch of short stories within this, like how Raymond Chandler stories first started. You know, they were kind of in Black Mask magazine, and, you know, and then he kind of pulled the novels out of that. So, you know, you cram a couple mm-hmm. together, and I thought that could be fun. And then my, you know, friend who knows publishing is like, you can't sell it. Yeah, no. Off the bat, some short stories.
Not at first.
Yeah, not at first. Like, no. So, you know, I didn't know, and it was all kind of fun and experimental, and, you know, and it was kind of for me. So the fact that then when someone was like, we want to publish it, it's like, oh, that's amazing. And there's no real expectations. And then I guess it's, so it's weird that as it goes on, you do more, you'd expect a greater level of confidence. So yeah, it's that thing where you'd think more confidence had come, but with, you know, but now it's like, oh, I'm meant to actually be an author now. I'm meant to know what I'm doing. So a different level of expectation and kind of self-critique comes. So and you're never doing the same thing twice. Like, I think in any creative endeavor, and I guess I know that as an actor, that the moment you go into any acting role and just think like, because generally you end, if you do a role for a while, by the end, you feel so, at the beginning, you're pulling your hair out and you're stressing over everything. You don't sleep before the first day of shooting. And you're just waiting for that little bit of, you know, positive feedback from the director or for someone else. And then by the last day of shooting, you just like, you know this character inside and out. You don't have to, if they've got an accent or you just know how to drop into them. You know how to go like, no, that doesn't feel right. Maybe it should be more like this. And you can just trust it. And then if you take that confidence and think like, oh, I've worked out acting, and you go into your next job and think like, cool, I can just plug right in, here we go, you're going to fall to pieces. And yeah. It's happened to me. I've seen it happen to other actors. It's like, after that first real triumph, usually the next thing you're going to have a complete, unless you understand that you are now a student again, you are, that this character is a new thing that you know nothing about, and you must go in knowing that you know nothing and be ready to do all the work and build it up, you're in trouble. And I think that's the same thing with writing, that unless you're just going to deliver the same thing again, you've got to go in You know, and that's why, like, Fetch's shifts are subtle in some ways, but also quite, like, he's kind of a different guy in each book, whatever he's gone through. I don't worry too much, you know, about going, does this feel right for Fetch? It's just like, put yourself in his position right now through his eyes, feeling what he feels and how would he react to this. And offer, and throwing this thing at him with what's happened to him, what would that do? And so in that, well, you know, I sometimes can be quite meticulous with the planning of the plot. You know, you kind of try and meticulously plan what the other people are doing, what the antagonist might do, or what the crime is and what they're up to. How the hero's going to react to it, I don't often really know until we get into it. And often that'll shift and you go like, I really wanted to get here, but I feel like forcing them to get to that point just doesn't feel right. So things are going to shift. And so even though I plan it a lot, often then by the end of it, it's different enough and sometimes weird enough and strange enough that by the time I'm sending it off to people, I have no idea whether, even though, like, you know, when you pitch the next book to the publishers or whatever, you write a little one page, it's like the next great installment of the Fetch Phillips, you know, archives is going here and this happens. And before it's written, I can say this is the greatest thing you're ever going to fucking read. And, you know, like, it's like, this will be amazing. Just wait. But by the time it's done, I think if you've done it, like if you haven't just painted by numbers and you've actually really gone in and run that razor's edge of what is interesting but also is true and is complicated, then you end up with something that I don't think, like, yeah, like I you know, mostly got, you know, really good reviews for each one of them, but I think I've only ever felt relief. That's kind of the most I get. When someone comes back and you get a glowing review, I'm just like, phew, great. I just want it because the fear is that I've really screwed something up, or I've gone way off base, or I've explored something that either other people don't find that interesting, or they're like, yeah, you're coming to some obvious conclusions here, or it's like, oh, we didn't even know what you're on about. So, yeah, I think it's I feel like I'm never going to get to the point where I'm with anything creative where I'm like, I know what I'm doing now. Let me just sit down, do the hours. I'll deliver something that I'm going to feel fine about.
do the hours for fiction is a good practice. But I think you've got a very pragmatic attitude. And I think that is, you know, like you said, it applies to acting, it applies to writing, but I think it applies to so many different creative endeavors. But, you know, As you say, finding that razor's edge between what feels true, you know, as well as interesting, is just going to result in a story that is genuinely reflective of you, and as a result, is genuinely reflective of Fetch, because it's like, oh shit, the story surprised me. We're going that way instead of this way. To a reader, you know, for you, it might come across as like a very big surprise because it's like you already had this forethought of what's coming in the story and you're like, fuck, that's way different. I don't know where I'm going.
Yeah.
But for the reader, you know, from my perspective, reading your books, it feels genuine for the character, for Fetch, and for the sort of thrust and narrative that he's been following through these three books.
And as well, you go, you know, it's always, once you've made that change, and if you do that, as long as you're happy doing the work and get excited by all the shifts, then you go, once that's the new story and you forget the old version, you come in and you can do all, you staple all the bits together that make it feel like that was planned from the start. Hopefully that just takes that's just that next draft to go like, oh, hang on, well, I better set that up and put this thing there. Yeah. And
like
I do,
like a beautiful Frankenstein that you just have to smooth out the edges every single time.
Exactly. Exactly. And the second and third are less like that. Like the first, you know, I do the first one, I say I kind of played it like an accordion. You just go, okay, it's going to go here. No, chop all that stuff out and bring it there, because I didn't know it was going to be a book at the start. The second and the third definitely had a more, you know, a structure that was there from the beginning. So the changes were never quite as dramatic. But also I think, but it will be interesting from here, because I think, definitely without saying too much, that there's a kind of, it's a subtle but kind of nice little arc, these three books for Fetch. I think he kind of, if there was one lesson he needed to learn across the three books, he's kind of got close to it by the end of the third, potentially, you know. And I think, which is really interesting to get, like, it's not, it doesn't mean you know, there's maybe not huge shifts in a lot of ways, but it feels like the right, you know, the right place to leave him at that point. And so it's just a little bit of deciding at the moment whether it's going to be another fetch book next or I'm going to write something else for a bit, you know, let him sit, you know, let that story sit. And then it's also like I'm getting more interested now and going like, even though this world is made for Fetch and he's made for the world, mm-hmm. you go like, well, there is probably room now to start bringing some other point of view characters in because
yeah,
we go like, okay, he's got to that point and I know more about the world and we've had these other characters who've already been dropped in. So I think from letting him kind of complete that little circle means there's now a chance for things to explode in new ways going forward.
No, I love that. And that's exactly what I was going to ask you about is sort of like what the future of Fetch as a character, but also the series. And I love that you want to bring more POV characters into it. Cause it's like, I read someone like Eileen Tide and I'm just like, you're fucking awesome. I want to know more about you. It's like, you're a librarian, but you're so interesting. Yeah. So just like, give me more of her. Just, I feel like the world has a lot to offer and you could present diverse perspectives that really flesh that out. And maybe seeing Fetch from the outside, people get to understand him a little bit more too.
That's definitely the fun thing is like, as I'm kind of outlining this next one with these other point of view characters, these moments where each of them will get to see Fetch is going to be fun. Cause he's so, and that's partly what'll be playing with as well, which I find interesting is how we see ourselves compared to how other people see us. And mm-hmm. so playing that not only with Fetch, but with everyone else, these people that we've only seen through his point of view, getting to actually drop into their heads and see how they feel themselves and the roles they play and why they do some of the things they do. So that's definitely that in the next Sunder installment, that is the plan. Mm-hmm. Whether that's the next book I release or not, we'll be working out soon, I think. Got a million plates in the air.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's awesome. I mean, whatever you release next, I'm really looking forward to it. And I want to close out with just a couple of questions. First off, who is one of your favorite morally gray characters or worlds, since we've been kind of straddling that line?
I'm just going to go really obvious, only because I was back in buying comic books yesterday and stuff. It's like Wolverine's just a guy. It's funny, just one of those ones. And I know it's like a, you know, that maybe feels a little mainstream, but I still, in a similar way, one of those early characters that I guess kind of got under my skin early on. And, you know, whoever's drawing him, acting him, writing him, it's you know, it feels like one of those old friends of pop culture that I love going back to.
Just a compelling guy. And you got the mustache to match up with that mood, man. You're all set.
And not the tallest guy, you know, there's something in that too, I think, that like,
yeah,
I'll be really annoyed if they cast
an adamantium skeleton, man. It's all good.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I'll be really annoyed if they cast another, you know, 6 foot someone dude as the next Wolverine. It's like we need
at least you're Australian. Game. You're halfway there.
So, we'll see how we go. Yeah.
Awesome. And what are you currently reading? I mean, we mentioned earlier that you're sort of playing catch up with a lot of SFF these days, but what are you currently reading or watching or listening to?
Watching. I just finished Severance this week. Ooh. Which is so good.
I want to get around to that. Yeah.
It's really beautifully done. I'm reading Plato's Republic at the moment, which is actually like, I'm like,
dude, we're 2 years into the pandemic. What's going on with you?
Yeah, that's right. That's one of those ones. But I'm really enjoying it. It's making me kind of like chuckle a bit more than I expected. You know, it's like, I'm really enjoying the tone of it. And I travel around everywhere with heaps of books and I'm about to go to the airport. I've already got too much luggage, but I bought some other comics yesterday. I haven't actually read any Swamp Thing. So I've got the recent run of Swamp Thing as well as the Alan Moore one, which I had.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you've read the Alan Moore one. That one.
No, so I got that, but I'm loving the. I've just been seeing kind of following the artists on this new one that I guess been going for the last year or something, and I'm really loving that. So that's kind of what drew me in. But I'm like, well, I've got to do the Alan Moore one. So they're the kind of things I'm carrying around with me at the moment. There's always a bunch of books. As far as sci-fi fantasy stuff goes, I'm probably even though I'm meant to be playing catch up, I think it's been a little while since my brain, it's, you know, it all vanishes from your brain. Come on, yeah. Man. So that's it. But there we go. There's, I need to dig back in, but you know, I'll get, I'll finish Plato's Republic first and then I'll jump back in.
Oh, you're good. That's some dense stuff, man. Come on.
Yeah. That's it. That's why it's moving a bit slow, I think, and why I can't remember whatever I was reading before. Yeah.
It's all good, man. But I really appreciate you taking the time today, Luke, chatting with me and taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you got to get going soon, but thank you so much. If you could tell listeners and viewers where they can find you on social media or where they can see you on television or whatnot, and where they can pick up the Fetch Philip archives.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This was really great and I really appreciate it. I'm Long Luke Arnold on Twitter and Instagram, like Long John Silver, but me. And the One Foot in the Fade, third book in the Fetch Phillips archives, comes out. You know, it always the best thing is to ask your local bookstore, because then if they don't have it in, you know, to get it in, that is ideal. But
brick and mortar.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, especially post-pandemic. That is the ideal place to do it. The audiobook's also available, which I record myself. So if you're an audiobook person, that's worth checking out too. It's around. And then acting-wise, unfortunately, I can't yet talk about the thing I'm working on at the moment, but there's if you're a Black Sails fan and want to see me returning to some kind of action adventure role, then follow me on social media and you'll hear something soon.
Right on. Go watch Black Sails again, because that show was awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's always worth a rewatch. I'm due, yeah. I think.
Biased, but fuck it. It's all good.
Yeah. No, it's weird. I know it's probably not cool, but I'm just such a fan of that show. And it's the great thing when you're in an ensemble show as well, because it's not like I'm in every scene, you know, I get these whole periods of the show where I get to just watch other really talented people be amazing. And then every now and then you're like, oh, that's right, I'm in this too. I forgot. But yeah, there's enough bits without me to enjoy it without my own face there. Yeah.
Well, for you, I mean, for everyone else, it's like, yeah, the parts with Luke in it are awesome too. So,
yeah, that's right. You get that. You might not, you know, it's funny. Like, you do a lot of things, and we all often don't like hearing our own voice, and you know, can cringe at ourselves. But there's something about that show that I just love so much. Can kind of get caught up in the whole thing and forget I was even a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it when it was coming out, and I've since met my wife and we moved to Ecuador together, and I'm just like, I gotta rewatch it with her, because like I really want her to see it, because it's like one of those shows I was watching when I was living in Germany, and I'm just like, yeah man, this is good stuff.
Yeah, well, enjoy the rewatch, and
thank you, man.
Yeah, but no, thanks very much, and yeah, this was great, really appreciate it.
There we have it. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Luke Arnold. If you like this episode, please subscribe, rate and review us on your platform of choice, and share us with your friends. It helps a lot and we greatly appreciate it. You can follow SFF Addicts on Twitter or Instagram at SFFAddictsPod for updates and more, or shoot us an email at sffaddictspod@gmail.com. You can also follow me, Adrian M. Gibson, on Twitter or Instagram at Adrian M. Gibson. SFF Addicts is part of FamFiAddict.com, so make sure to check us out there for the latest in book reviews, essays, and all things sci-fi and fantasy, as well as the full episode archive for the podcast. All music comes courtesy of the talented Astronauts. Check them out on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/STRONOZ. All links for the episode are also available in the show notes. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.